Listeners, shoppers, welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, you kind of hinted at what we're talking about today.
Love hints.
Yes, we are talking about consumer boycotts. If you were like me last week, my group chats were flooded with messages about the economic blackout that took place on February 28th. It was all over social media. Even my aunt, who is not very savvy online, told me about it. Okay? But it wasn't that effective. Womp womp. And so it got us all thinking. I mean, it's very empowering to think that you could take down a big corporate giant like Walmart or Amazon by simply not spending your money. But then you hear it doesn't work. So we decided to talk about this issue. We brought in some experts and we're going to get into it. When do boycotts work? When do they fail? And are there smarter ways to vote with our dollars? I'm looking forward to our conversation. And our question to you at home today is, how do politics influence where you shop or what you buy? Do you think it's possible to create change by voting with your dollars? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're on YouTube, you can drop your comment in the chat. And Avi, I think about, you know, Amazon, how much we rely on companies like this, how cheap Walmart is for a lot of folks and how close and convenient it is. And the question is more than, do you want to make a difference? Do you want to be empowered and influence corporations? But the question is, could you give up your sparkling water? Could you give up the convenience of having, you know, toothpaste delivered at your doorstep? That's the question.
But isn't it also more convenient than ever to pick a second option?
It is.
So I feel like it could be easier.
It could be easier, but that's the question. And what would motivate large numbers of people to really get on board?
I use it, but I don't like toothpaste.
Oh.
That's a different conversation.
That's a whole nother. I was kind of shocked because I sit next to you.
By the way, big announcement before we get into our trio of local news stories. DJ of the Day is back. Folks, we're bringing it back. So if you forgot, DJ of the Day, we used to do this every Thursday. We asked for you to submit a song for us to close the show with today. It's got to be related to the theme of today's show. You submit your nominations via email to producer Paige. Email studio2@whyy.org before 12:30 with what song you're picking and why you're picking it. And one of you will be our lucky DJ of the day. We'll shout you out at the end of the show and we'll play the song that you submitted. DJ of the day, it's back.
Yeah, and the theme, of course, is boycotts. I wonder what
or
song
shopping,
or shopping or
money,
consumerism.
Consumerism.
Yeah, it's so many different
your
things.
Argument.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing. I kind of missed DJ of the day.
I don't like that you threw kinda in there.
Yeah, I did.
I definitely missed it.
Because we've had some really good song choices. I love our listeners. So.
Absolutely. Studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories. And if you were recently laid off by the federal government, Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania has a message for you. He wants you to work for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. An executive action signed this week allows federal workers who've lost their job to apply to Pennsylvania government jobs in a way that's somewhat streamlined. Here is Governor Shapiro speaking at a press conference yesterday.
Some of them might have been laid off recently, and some of them, well, they might just be looking for a change right now. If they're qualified and they want to serve Pennsylvanians, well, hear me on this. We want you on our team.
So there you have it, from the governor looking to recruit folks who have already worked in government and may be looking for a change or have been laid off because of the actions of DOJ.
Yeah, I think it makes sense to go after these folks. They're public servants, right? They're used to all the protocols that it takes to work for the federal government. So why not bring them on into the state government? And I wonder if other states will follow suit. I think, Pennsylvania has about 104,000 federal workers. And we don't know how many people were let go, but, you know, maybe a few hundred could possibly come on board. I don't know.
I believe some other states have already done this. I don't think Pennsylvania is the first. I think New York
and
Maryland might have already jumped on this. Don't quote me on it, but okay. I believe I wasn't sure you were going to bring that up. But yeah, I think Pennsylvania is at the forefront of this, but not the first.
Not the first. Okay.
Let's hop over to New Jersey now.
Yes. Well, everyone kind of knows that New Jersey is one of the most expensive states for homeowners because of high property taxes. Well, now those property taxes have reached a new level. And for the first time ever, the average tax bill is over $10,000.
Five figures. The people are pumped.
Yes. And they're probably a little, another P word. But the record high average comes after a year over year increase of $300, which puts the price over the line in 2024. It's about 3% higher than the average cost the year before, which was, get this, $9,800. So, by the way, New Jersey's taxes for real estate are now the highest in the nation. But, you know, I would mention that there are big differences depending upon where you live. Like if you live in Essex County, the average is $13,000 a year. And Bergen and Morris and Union counties, they have the highest tax bills. Now, in Cumberland County, the average tax bill is $4,900. Cape May, $6,400. Down here in South Philly, it tends to be a little lower than South Jersey tends to be a little lower than North Jersey. By the way, one of the reasons why Jersey real estate taxes is so high, well, they don't have like local sales tax, like the counties can't charge that. And so they rely a lot on property taxes to pay for schools as well as for county government functions.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I don't know how much stock people put in these lists, but if you look at these national lists, people rank the schools in New Jersey very highly.
Yeah, so I know people who work as teachers. They get paid much better than they do over here.
Much better. In fact, I believe, according to a recent list, the average starting salary for a New Jersey teacher was second in the country.
Yeah.
So that money does go somewhere.
Yeah.
It's interesting with taxes. Mm-hmm. Like, if you went into a store, if you went into Best Buy, and there was a $300 television and a $600 television, you would understand that the $600 television is offering you some things, the $301 is not. So there's a trade-off. You could pay more, and you could get more, you could pay less, and you could get less. People do not tend to view taxes that way, but you could make the argument that that is what is happening in New Jersey.
In New Jersey. And by the way, I should mention that relief could be coming because Governor Murphy's new budget includes $3 billion in relief for this growing property tax burden. And with the governor's race coming up this year, you know that real estate taxes will probably be a big issue in Jersey.
Speaking of relief, how about some comic relief? Ho! A new Hulu series.
That was a good transition, by
Thank
the
you.
Way.
Thank you. Maybe I should write for a comedy show like Hulu's new series based on a fictional Philadelphia corner store. The series is called Deli Boys, and it follows two brothers. What was funny about that?
No, I just like the name.
Okay.
Deli Boys.
Okay.
And they look funny. Like, by the way, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see the picture.
Anyway. Yeah, they look like they have comedic chops.
Exactly.
So it's called Deli Boys. It follows two brothers who have to take over the family's corner store in Philly after their dad suddenly dies. Here's the twist. The store was actually a front for all sorts of criminal activity, and now these brothers are in deep, and the feds are sniffing around. Here's a clip from the new show, Deli Boys, set in Philadelphia.
Huh. I got a hunch that you Dars are up to something worse than tax fraud.
Ma'am, there is nothing worse than tax fraud.
I'm taking this tasty cake.
Okay, you can have it. Thank you.
I actually think the show looks very funny and very interesting. It's a good premise.
Dark humor. I could see it.
Shout out to Tasty Cake there. Mm-hmm. And the creator, Abdullah Saeed, went to Temple and wrote for the alt-weekly Philadelphia Weekly. He says the show is based on a deli that he used to go to in Northern Liberties. That was according to the Inquirer. And the executive producer showrunner, Michelle Nader, was born and raised in South Philly. And by the way, she was the writer and showrunner for Two Broke Girls on CBS, which starred Kat Dennings from Bryn Mawr. So it's all Philly, baby. It's all Philly.
Yeah. So I think, you know, living in Philly, I'm you know, we're from Maryland. I didn't really have a corner store, but everywhere I've lived in Philly, I've always had a little corner store, a little poppy store at the end of the block.
Yeah.
You got to have eggs. You got to have some basic stuff, milk, eggs, you know, things that you can, some good snacks, maybe some hoagies, you know.
Well, that's what distinguishes, I think, a great corner store from a good corner store is are they making something in the back that's maybe a little fresh or semi-fresh?
Semi-fresh is probably.
That's got a little something to it. Like there is the best example, and this is a higher end corner store, but there's this place right off Baltimore Avenue in West Philly called Fuwa.
Ooh.
And they make this tofu hoagie that is really quite excellent.
Wow.
And they make some other stuff too. And the one around the corner from me, for I don't know how they source this, but they are making water ice. And it's pretty good. And
wow.
It's very, very cheap. It's weirdly cheap.
Well, I've just moved to the Fishtown East Kensington area, and I've been lurking around my corner store. I haven't gone in yet, but now this is going to make me go check it out. I don't know.
You're lurking?
I was lurking. But I'm going to go in
there.
Was
off in there?
I wasn't sure. You know,
okay.
New neighborhood. Still checking it out.
Nothing wrong with being cautious.
Yeah.
Okay, so coming up on Studio 2, our big topic today is consumer boycotts. Do they work? When do they work? Why do they work? Or why don't they work? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Last week, a grassroots organization called for a nationwide economic blackout to protest the reversal of DEI policies at major retailers like Target, Amazon, and Walmart. And some of the people who took part in the 24-hour boycott, well, they hoped it could hit the companies where it hurt. Others plan to make a political statement with their dollars. But if you look at the profit, the blackout didn't seem to make a dent in the bottom line for these massive retailers. In fact, Amazon saw an increase in web traffic that day.
The model of cheaper goods, a streamlined, comfortable experience, and even same-day shipping has become central to how most Americans shop. And it's not just the fun stuff. Lots of people turn to these retailers for basic necessities like groceries and toothpaste. That convenience, along with typically lower prices, makes it difficult to get consumers to not just rethink how they shop, but to actually shop elsewhere.
And so today we're asking if consumer boycotts actually work and how we could even measure the impact in today's retail ecosystem. And joining us now in our studio is Americus Reed, professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Americus, welcome to Studio 2.
I'm very excited to be here. Yeah.
We're really excited to have you. We're also excited to have Jordan Holman joining us remotely. She is a business reporter covering the retail industry and consumerism for the New York Times. Jordan, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And so
we have a question also for our listeners. I want to make sure we get that out there. Do politics influence where you shop or what you buy? Do you think it's possible to create change by voting with your dollars? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org, also with your Studio 2 DJ of the Day submission. Or on YouTube, you can drop a comment right there in the chat.
Yes, and we look forward to hearing from you. So you heard in our intro that economic blackout did not make a dent. And so if people really wanted to use the power of the purse to take down a corporate giant like Walmart, Amazon, or Target, Americus, what would it take?
Yeah, it's a great question, Cherry. I think that a big point of this is that I would have not expected anything to happen in the small time frame of a day. So that's not surprising.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we expect in more of a long-term sort of a frame is if people can maintain the energy, which is awfully hard to do, if they can sustain the effort and the motivation to continue to, like you were saying, inconvenience themselves, then you might start seeing a little bit of a dent here. But typically, these things are not effective because there's many different factors that are working against you in terms of these sorts of things that are boycotts or bycotts that really take you away from the energy that's required to actually sustain this kind of an effort.
And so what would it take, though? Like, if you say, yes, this didn't work, you knew that wasn't going to work, but what would it take?
Well, it's a couple things. Number one, it takes a certain level of collective awareness. So the way that I look at this one day sort of all in approach is to say that we're going to raise the national consciousness of this issue first, and then we're going to put the awareness of it in front of people. Now, at that point, what's required is a steady stream of telling consumers how their individual efforts can sort of level up into larger effects. So every individual consumer never feels like they have power because they're sort of isolated in their own psychology. But once they see other people are actually joining this effort, it's something that we call social proof. It's proof that it's legitimate. It's proof that it's actually worth your time and effort and energy. So you become more aware and you become more likely to actually engage in it, because you see others. And if that happens, and the way we think about this is, how do we get something from a moment to a movement? And that is to say that what you need is you need this collective energy rising, and then we need the media covering it, talking about it, because then that feeds sort of the conversation and elevates the additional buzz and energy that's required to keep this thing going. And if you don't have those two elements, number one, awareness, number two, a groundswell of collective social proof, and then number three, the media actually elevating and continuing to keep this in the conversation, you're not going to have a successful outcome.
Jordan Holman, I want to view this from the side of the businesses. Like, where are their pain points? Because I think you probably have to understand that before you understand how you would get them to take action on your cause.
Yeah, I mean, for any retailer, the consumer's at the heart of their business. Are people coming into their stores or shopping on their websites? So I understand a boycott, or I love how America said a boycott. That is the heart of their business. But when it comes to thinking about, like, it's really important to think about timing of the year. For a publicly traded company like a Walmart or Target, you know, what part of the quarter is it? Is this a really key time? So think about like Black Friday. That would be a pain point if everyone kind of decided, I'm not shopping on one of the biggest days of the year that you guys plan months for. This Friday on a February, it's harder to gauge if that was actually a super important day traffic wise for them. So I was just one of the things is like kind of thinking about the timing of boycotts like this is really key for retailers.
Is there a type of consumer they really care about a lot too? Younger, older, regular, irregular? Like, and I know all these retailers and services are a bit different, but if I'm trying to organize one of these, I guess I want to capture the imagination of the consumer that captures their imagination.
Yeah, I love that question. I mean, like the PR answer is every consumer matters. But when you really think about it, it's like that high frequency consumer. So someone who is coming in every week buying the groceries is also ordering things online. So it's not just like walking into their store, but has their app. Relies on them for those last minute purchases. The most valuable customer to a retailer is someone who uses their omni-channel model. You're walking in the store, you're using their app, you're talking about how much you love going there. You're the customer who's walking in the store with only two items on your list and you walk away with 10 items. And so that demographic will change for each retailer, like you said. But often it is someone who is middle income, has money, has a job. Often it's buying for their family. So thinking of mothers, like that is a very valuable customer for retailers.
Yeah, and I think about spending power, right? According to Black Wall Street, Black spending power is set to be $1.98 trillion in 2025. Latino spending power was $3.4 trillion in 2023. And women influence about 85% of purchasing decisions in households. And so when we think about harnessing economic power, how do you sort of do that? Because it seems like people's knee-jerk reaction is to say boycott, but if that doesn't work, but they have all this power at the same time, Americus.
That's a great question, Cherry. I think that we have to get them to realize that that power is power. I think they don't necessarily understand that their individual unique contribution scales up to something that these companies will pay attention to. And I would just add to that other piece, this notion of the consumer has to have in their mind something about a moral analysis that says, this is important enough for me to, like you were saying earlier, to inconvenience myself. Mm-hmm. And you need that moral component, because at the end of the day, the decision to actually do something to try to rally the troops, if you will, is going to be dependent on how strongly you value the thing that is that you are trying to protest against. And so oftentimes we forget that it's the ability to maintain this moral muscle is contingent on your ability to actually take care of other things in your life. So if you're struggling with bills, if you're trying to pay for rent, if you're focused on sort of the challenges of life, it's hard to take the moral high ground, because you're going to have to sort of forget about these needs that you have in order to be this superior moral being that acts in the world. So again, what you need is you need other people connecting with you, mm-hmm. talking about it, saying, hey, Americus, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to do X. Well, I can't do X, but I'm going to do Y. Okay. And then this conversation can become the roadmap that the consumer can use to have, like you all were saying, multiple options to try to harness that power and to not be constrained by economic conditions.
Yeah, Jordan, have you seen that in recent years where people have been able to sort of convince consumers to get on board and to not just talk about it on social media, but to actually take action?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it in a few cases over the past few years. Well, think about 2020. People did shift their consumer behavior in response to Black Lives Matter, wanting to shop with Black-owned businesses or with Black-owned brands at these businesses like Target and Walmart. That was a large part started on social media, with a lot of people sharing resources. These are the brands you can shop. And people then actually went out and shopped, or like went online and shopped. So that was an example of conversation on social media turning to sales. More recently than that, you look at what happened with Target's Pride Day collection in 2023. That was more of a conservative conversation saying, we don't like the products that they have for LGBTQ apparel for kids and various other things. But people went into the stores, voiced their displeasure, sometimes yelling or angrily, but saying, I am not going to shop at Target because I do not like what they have in terms of Pride Month. And then they did not. And that was reflected in the sales. That quarter, Target sales actually dropped 5%. And their chief merchants attributed some of that drop to the Pride Day backlash that they got. So we have seen examples on kind of both sides of the aisle, if you will.
And I invite you to join this conversation by giving us a call, 888-477-9499, emailing studio2@whyy.org, or dropping a comment in the YouTube live chat. Our question for you today: do politics influence where you shop or what you buy? Do you think it's possible to create change by voting with your dollars? Let's bring in a caller right now. This is Ryan from North Philly on line one. Ryan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey, thanks for having me. My comment is that it all comes down to organization. I think this organization was not done by somebody who has experience in organizing communities, because if we look at Black revolutionaries, the idea is to keep the dollars within the community that serves you best. And we haven't been doing that. Another matter is that it can't just last one day. One day doesn't do anything if you're going back tomorrow to buy whatever else that you waited a single day to pay for.
Interesting comment there from Ryan in North Philly. So, Americus, I think we've all concluded here that one day is not going to make a big difference. Can one day ever be a springboard to many more days?
Yeah, I think it can. And I think that's the best way to think about it, is to see it as sort of, this is the jumping off point of a longer campaign to try to sustain that sort of energy. The other thing I'll add to build on Ryan's point is to say that you have now this social media thing that is layered on top of all this. And it's a challenge, because social media tricks you into thinking you're doing something by like blocking out, you know, I put the black square up on my Instagram and like, okay, now I'm done in terms of whatever it is that I need to do to be moral.
Interesting.
So part of it is, how do you get your question? How do you get people to not just post something and have moral outrage on social media, but how do you get them to actually go get the signs, get the markers, stand, take off of work, stand on the corner, and actually, you know, have their voices heard? So there's an interesting dynamic that's going on that saps the energy from these sorts of attempts, because people feel like they're doing something and they actually aren't.
Yeah, I want to play this video. It's kind of funny to me. Social media has been, as you mentioned, flooded with these calls to boycott. But, you know, this person was in a Target and it's kind of funny. But I want to play this and get your thoughts after we take a look and listen to what was said here.
Sis, what you doing up in here? We supposed to be boycotting.
Oh,
you know, we ain't supposed to be up in here.
You ain't here.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm proud of you. Give me a hug. Give me a hug. I'm proud of you.
And by the way, that person was in a Target in Pittsburgh talking to women that they were saying, black women specifically, saying, hey, we're not supposed to be shopping at Target right now. And one of the women actually put the products back. And so I think about the 24-hour boycott or the blackout, Jordan, and I think about the awareness step that Americus was talking about. How long, if you try to lay it out in a timeline, you know, people are mad about this, the rollback of DEI. How long, if you were looking at a timeline for a boycott, would this type of thing have to happen if you want to sort of take that economic blackout and take it into more where it's an actual movement where these corporate giants feel it?
I think we have to look back at history. And I know it's like hard to sometimes rewind the clock to the 50s, but like the boycott, the Montgomery bus boycott was more than a year, and it had all of the elements that Americus was talking about. It had that kind of community support, the I know this might be tough, but we're all in this together. You also can look at boycotts against department stores back in the 50s and 60s. Think about the sit-ins at lunch counters. Those were months-long sustained action that was very in-your-face and public. I think one dynamic here, life has changed a lot and society has changed a lot, but another dynamic here is we have e-commerce. Yes, you can maybe not go in the store, but how do you communicate to people that it's even important to not purchase things online? So that's another dynamic that kind of complicates this timeline.
Because you could sneak by in some way. Yeah. I mean, I'm joking. I'm saying this, but you could literally order your stuff and no one would know. And part of it was, you think about the Montgomery bus boycott, you could be publicly shamed if you were seen on a bus.
Yeah.
But now you could get the stuff delivered and no one would know.
100%. Yeah. And I want to actually get into that conversation of how today's, I don't know, economy makes it easier or harder, right, to make these boycotts stick and last. But first, let me read in some comments. Here's Martin, who says, I don't personally participate in boycotts. Why? Because hurting those companies' stock prices means hurting people's retirements. For these big corporations, the biggest investors are institutional investors like teachers' retirement plans. They will be punished by a low stock price more than the executives. In my opinion, a more effective boycott is to fully reorient ourselves to prioritize local and small businesses at all times, not just when we're mad at big companies for recent actions. Let's bring in another caller now. This is Paul from Philadelphia on line one. Hey, Paul, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Good afternoon. Hey, I was thinking my comment was that I actually participated in a one-day protest, but if we were to compare the protests, that one day protest, to maybe the NFL protest that happened, I think the biggest difference is that there were like social media influencers involved, so people felt like they were a part of something. And in today's culture, I think the influencers play a lot of part in kind of swaying the masses. So if there was maybe a bigger kind of protest where influencers were doing it, there was a hashtag, it felt more like a movement rather than just a one-day thing, it might have been caused a little bit more of a stir, because it would have been more grassroots, but it would have been like, we're all doing this together. And at that point, people would feel bad for being left out of the protest, per se.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nice perspective there from Paul. So I teed this up earlier, Americus, the modern shopping economy. How does it help or hurt the ability for people to organize in this way around boycotts or boycotts?
Yeah, it's a great question, Avi. I think that, you know, the information search costs are zero. And so the problem that Jeff Bezos has given all of us is that he's taught us that we now expect to live in a completely frictionless world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So by the way, the data is
I want super, it now, I get it now.
I get it right now or else. And that's what people expect. So the idea that, you know, you have to give that up is really, really hard, because it's not so much you love the convenience, you love the fact that it's super easy, and you've almost, it's like a sunk cost in undoing that. In order to be able to say, hey, you know, I need to make my voice heard on this other issue, is just very, very onerous. So I think the fact that we have, consumers have, and Jordan said this as well, the consumers have so many options that it's challenging to pick out one and actually try to go for it, because you have all this other hidden stuff that you might get called out on in social media. That clip that you all showed was a great example of this. I mean, consumer vigilantes, they're out there with their phones, mm-hmm. and they can literally put you on blast right there. So there mm-hmm. is like a feedback mechanism that's here, that's part of this online omni-channel digital ecosystem that we're all operating in. And I think it's making it easier in some senses to participate in a superficial way, but it's making it harder to actually do it in a way that people are going to be very credible about. And I would say, be very careful about influencers, to the point that Martin was making, because you pick the wrong influencer to come in and be the sort of the figurehead of the movement, and they're not seen as authentic and in that community as part of the grassroots effort, and you're going to actually have a situation that actually ends up backfiring and actually takes you backwards with respect to your progress around the boycott.
Yeah, I remember those celebrities, so they all sang Imagine together, and everyone hated that. Yes. For some reason. Sort of reminds me of that.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And by the way, we want to encourage your participation in today's conversation. How do politics influence where you shop or what you buy? And do you think it's possible to create change by voting with your dollars? You can call 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your comment in the chat. I want to read a couple comments. AGB said on YouTube, I stopped shopping at Target completely after they announced the rollback of DE&I efforts, including removing Black-owned business products from their shelves. And Melanie said the recent boycott made a big difference to the local businesses. It energized our community. It empowered consumers to make their voices heard and improve the bottom line for the family shops. And so I know we're about a minute plus from a break, but I want to play another clip to set up a discussion on the other side about collateral damage. This is Tabitha Brown, who's become a very popular social media personality, and she's a serial entrepreneur and has products at Target. And she came out with this statement when part of the boycott was announced, and take a listen to what she had to say.
If we all decide to boycott and be like, no, we're not spending no money at these organizations. Listen, I get it. And if that's how you feel, honey, I 1000% get it. But so many of us will be affected, and our sales will drop. Our business will be hurt.
Now, she got some backlash related to this commentary, but I want to kind of tee up the conversation to talk about some of the collateral damage, like who gets hurt by some of these boycotts and what other economic levers we have as consumers to be able to affect corporations and make them change their moral standing on different issues. And so we want to hear from you, our listeners.
Yeah, studio2@whyy.org, 888-477-9499, or leave a comment in the YouTube chat. Sherry emails and says the bus boycott during the civil rights movement was over 300 days. Mm-hmm. One day is not enough. KG says, I am boycotting Whole Foods because Bezos kissed the ring. I am now primarily shopping at Giant, Acme, Wegmans, and Aldi. So just a couple perspectives. Keep them coming. Studio 2 at WHYY.org. And we'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, if you're just joining us, we're talking about consumer boycotts. Our guests are Americus Reed, professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and Jordan Holman, a business reporter covering the retail industry and consumerism for the New York Times.
And we're asking you, our listeners, this question. If politics influences where you shop or what you buy, do you think it is possible to create change by voting with your dollars? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your comment in the chat. Hannah said on YouTube, the boycott's failure disappointed me last Friday. But last Friday, I discovered two local bookstores in Delaware that I wouldn't have discovered had I just gone to Barnes & Noble, community through small business, exclamation point, says Hannah. And so I teed up a video of Tabitha Brown sort of talking about some of the collateral damage that could happen from some of these boycotts. And one of the benefits of the 2020 racial reckoning was that many small businesses of color, women-owned businesses, got the opportunity to sell their products in big retailers like Target. Who would be hurt by some of these large-scale boycotts against an Amazon, a Walmart, or a Target, America?
That's a great question, Cherry. I think that, you know, this is part the ripple effects. We were discussing this, in the break. It's huge, and the problem is that I once heard that the definition of stupidity is doing something and then not asking, okay, what's going to happen next? What comes next? Okay, now what happens? And so if you just jump in and you say, I'm going to just do something without having the consideration of, okay, well, wait a second. There are all these other businesses that might be a part of that ecosystem that I'm about to burn down with Jeff Bezos, and he's going to be fine because he's got billions of dollars. But what about these other companies? I think it needs to be made you need to be made aware. There needs to be some kind of organization that makes salient the idea of these are the players here, and this is their relative positioning in this ecosystem, so that when people make a decision to use their dollars to create power, that they are at least aware of these potential collateral damage effects. I don't think people even think about it. I think they think about it as a one-stop, okay, boom, I did it, and now I'm done. And now what the reason why we think about like a long-term effort, a long-term longitudinal strategic sort of a thing is because we're trying to, in a sense, account for all of these various ripple effects that might be important that we need to be aware of.
Yeah. Well, and lots of people have brought up the bus boycott and Don't Touch My Hair points out on YouTube that they gave people alternatives for how to get around. So they thought about who was going to be hurt. And they anticipated that and gave those folks other options through community organizing. So that just goes to that point there. Here's an email from Jason who says, I appreciate this form of protest, but it seems too easy to thwart. All a counter-protest effort would need is to rally supporters to purchase heavily at the targeted retailers on the targeted days. And so Jordan Holman, that brings me to a question about how these things play out in a super polarized political environment. Is it just equal and opposite reactions here?
That's a great comment from the listener. It can be, but I also wanted to bring up this other element that a lot of people are talking about that could be a counterforce to it, and it's the targeted boycott. So saying, I'm not going to buy anything within Target or Walmart or Amazon that does not align with my values. And so that can mean focusing on only purchasing from Black-owned companies. And further in Tabitha Brown's video, she does kind of talk about that targeted boycott, saying, put your money behind these businesses that like fought to get on these shelves so that these companies don't have a reason for saying, oh, it's not selling. And it defeats your purpose and you have less representation of Black-owned businesses or women-owned businesses, whatever your values are. So this idea of a targeted boycott kind of helps protect, you know, the mission that you have, saying, I want to see more of this over here.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller. We have Valerie from Philly on the line. Valerie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I'm calling to say, first off, I'm one of those high-frequency consumers that the marketing professor talked about in terms of shopping at Amazon, Whole Foods, Washington Post, and I pulled the plug on all of them. And what I want to say is, in pulling the plug, I discovered something wonderful, which is like life-changing. I'm spending less. I'm taking more time finding sources. You can do everything online. It's not a case that it inconveniences you. You can find, as I did, a beautiful mop from an independent store in Vermont and so on. So all of those things can be done online and be very targeted and be life-changing. The impact on Amazon vendors is a good thing because Amazon has been destructive to vendors and destructive to workers. These rich people who are running our political scene need to be stopped, and it needs to be long-term and life-changing for all of us.
Thank you so much. That's Valerie from Philadelphia. And this goes to my question to you, Jordan, because I've seen some of your reporting talking about boycotts. And so I want to talk about, we've talked about boycotts, which is the negative, removing your dollars from something. But how can you use boycotts to sort of be positive and support organizations like Valerie says, which can be life-changing to independent sellers?
Absolutely. So, a few weeks after Target announced that they were rolling back their DEI, I chatted with a lot of their vendors, a lot of Black-owned businesses, to hear like what do they want and need during this time? Because it was a very confusing time for them. They weren't given a heads up that Target, this company that they do business with, was going to just kind of pull the rug from under them either. So what did they need? And one of the things that they said is, please keep shopping with us and come directly to our website. A lot of these vendors, they have their own websites, and you can, you know, basically give them the full money. They don't have to give a cut to these other companies. They can fulfill your order. So I talked to one company, they're called Oh Happy Danny. They do journals and mugs and things. And she said, I'm pulling my stuff from Target, but hey, I still have this, I have this website. And she saw her sales skyrocket because people, individual people, maybe buying a sticker, a $2 sticker, all of that adds up for them. So that is one way, just directly support these businesses. And it will mean a lot more because their sales are like this compared to a large multinational
Yes.
company. So, like, that's one way that you can really kind of do your boycott.
And you know, that's part of the conversation that our caller Valerie was bringing up, which is how do you reframe the inconvenience as an opportunity for
Yes.
personal growth or business growth in this case? Let me bring in another caller. This is Francis from Newark, Delaware, and I have an idea. Francis might be giving us a little history lesson here. Francis, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my comment is that one thing that has not been brought up is the lettuce boycott
Yep.
by the United Farm Workers in the 1970s. I was in college then, and the UFW hired people, fanned them out across the country. They embedded in the community. They went to grocery stores. They went to college campuses. They organized us on the college campus. We met with the university president. And in our campus, he said, look, I'm not taking away iceberg lettuce, but I will bring in an alternative, and you can write a note. You can write a few sentences, and we will put it on the iceberg lettuce bin about why people should not buy iceberg lettuce, and people stopped buying it. Mm. Eventually, they stopped getting it. It was a successful boycott against agribusiness and against the way the UFW, obviously farm workers, were being treated. But people met in person. We met for hours in living rooms. We did that in the anti-war movement. We did that in the anti-nuke movement. Social media seems to me, as a 72-year-old, very isolating. It's hard to connect. But that was a successful boycott. I don't know how long it lasted, a long time, and it was all over the country.
Yeah. I believe Cesar Chavez was at the center of that. And there was protests around grapes as well. So it didn't end up just being lettuce. Thank you so much, Francis, from Newark, Delaware, talking about the hard work that it takes. And this goes to your point earlier, Americus, right, that sometimes social media tricks us into thinking we've done organizing when all we've really done is sort of blow into the bullhorn.
Yeah, peacocking.
Peacocking, yes, moral peacocking, virtue signaling. And I think that it's really interesting right now because we're trained now to put in as little effort as possible into the things that we care about because that's how we're rewarded. We're sort of, the dopamine hit comes from jumping on social media and pretending to be this crusader and getting the likes as opposed to having to really actually do the hard work. And so, you know, because we're living in a different world and how we consume media, it's going to require a different set of tactics. So I love that idea of like pooling little pods of influence and creating that sort of thing. I would share a quick story with you. A friend of mine called me up and was like, I'm going to Costco because Costco is one of the few companies that is not pulling the plug on the DEI work. You know, and that we were talking, it's like, hey, you know, I'm going, hey, why don't you buy me this? I'm going to give you my list. And we actually called up and like maybe 5 or 10 people. We're going to all go to Costco and buy and like spend as much money as Costco. But it's like a little tiny, like little pod of influence. Like you can start there and then build it out and scale it up. But I think to your point, it's going to require a totally different framing, totally different mindset of sort of the things that we need to be protesting against in terms of being having power as consumers.
Yeah, and I think that Costco has seen an uptick in memberships and things because of that. And I wanted to just sort of ask you, like, what are some of the other levers of influence that consumers have over these corporations? Because are there other avenues besides just the bottom line? Can you influence shareholders, for example? Like, what other things would get a company to sort of change their stance, America?
I love that question, Cherry. I think that there's a couple things that stand out to me. One is that there is sort of an ongoing question of, am I hurting my brand when I do this? In other words, when I step into the fray of these very radioactive political kinds of conversations and decision making where I'm doing something ideologically that may have nothing to do with my business model, for example. And I think what you need to understand, or what we need to understand as consumers, is that the stakeholders understand that the brands are assets, and the reason why we go and buy certain things is often because we see the value in that brand, we trust it, we have a relationship with it, and so forth. And so I think creating a groundswell where you're actually stirring a conversation and trying to, because the word of mouth piece is huge here as well, trying to get people to talk about this and share the information and talk about sort of talk about in bad terms the brand, the service, the organization, the negativity of that specific, you know, company that you're trying to boycott has a lot of power. So trying to hurt the brand, you can hurt it by hurting sales for sure, but you can also hurt its reputation. Yeah. And when you hurt the reputation, that's a long-term thing that can have some pretty dire consequences.
Yeah. I just want to read in a few more comments because we really do have some excellent ones today. Here's an email from Kenneth, apparently listening from north of the border. Wow. As residents of Canada, we're now living with what seems to be a pretty effective and widespread boycott, as surveys show that a majority of Canadians are now making a genuine effort to avoid buying products imported from the USA. Wow. Buy Canadian is on everyone's lips. Kathleen says, look to Gandhi's attempt to rid the British Empire, get the British Empire out of India. He urged people to gather their own salt from the sea to avoid the British salt tax. He urged people to spin their own cloth. Always nonviolent. We might buy secondhand clothing, make cleaning supplies from cheap ingredients, or find other ways to avoid major corporations. So DIYing your way to a solution. And one more from Galia, who says, it's especially difficult to boycott companies like Amazon because they'd create a monopoly on so many products. 10 years ago, I could have gone online and shopped around to find a product. Obviously today, much harder. So real quickly, Jordan Holman, the ubiquity of these companies, it does seem to be a big obstacle here. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it. I believe America said this earlier, it's frictionless. All these companies have invested billions of dollars over the years to make you think of them first, one click, and it makes it really easy. When you think about a Walmart, largest retailer in America, sometimes that is people's only store in a 10-mile radius. So yes, it is tricky, but there are small businesses. There are, depending where you are, there's bodegas. Like, you have to have a plan, but it is possible. You also maybe need to realize you could be paying more to get the products that you want. It's all about the trade-offs that you're willing to make. But by no way are these stores the only stores in the country. They would also argue that they shouldn't be the only stores. So you just have to kind of go out of your way and really think about this if you are trying to do a boycott.
Yeah.
Strategy.
And you may have to make a little bit of a sacrifice.
And yeah, those are the four S's. The four S's are strategy, strategy, and sacrifice. We cracked it. Thank you so much, Jordan Holman, business reporter covering the retail industry and consumerism for the New York Times. Really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks.
And thank you also to Americus Reed, professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Americus, great insights.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, so DJ of the day is back. The runner-up this week is from Rebecca. She got her submission in just too late, but it was a great one. She suggested the song Trash by the New York Dolls
because
she says trash is what rampant consumerism causes. And of course, we should note that the lead singer of the New York Dolls died this week.
Oh, wow.
A great loss for the music world. But our DJ of the day is actually three people.
Yes.
Mia, Edward, and Geraldine, who pick this song by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Shop Around. Let's hear it.
I know this one.
Perfect.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
Great way to close today's show. And to say thank you to everybody who wrote in, all of our callers, our YouTubers, and thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks so much to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calique, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. And shout out to our DJs of the day.
Yes.
From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We'll talk to you next week.